unconscious, in need of urgent medical help. Or maybe she's trapped. She could have sprained her ankle. What if she trod in a trap, a snare?
Like mine, Laura's imagination was full of images from films. Then why doesn't she cry out? I asked. Shout for help.
I don't know. But we have to try to find her. I couldn't live with myself if we just left her, Daniel. Give that to me.
She snatched the maglite from my grasp.
If you're too scared, she spat the word, then I'll go in on my own.
No, Laura. She strode off towards the trees. Come back! I lurched after her, catching her by the shoulder. She whirled around. All right, I said. I'm sorry. We'll go in together. Give me the torch.
Why should you?
Please, just give it to me. I couldn't bear the thought of not being in control of the light. Holding the torch, with Laura grasping my free hand, I faced down my fears. I knew I was being stupid. In the daytime, I would have happily run into the forest. We just needed to be careful, to watch where we were going. We would be fine, I repeated these words silently. Fine, fine, fine.
There's a path,
Laura said as we pushed through the first line of shrubbery following the beam of the torch. She was right. There was a natural path among the trees, about a meter across. Perhaps Alina had found it straight away and decided to walk a little way along it in search of a good place to answer the call of nature. Though why she had gone more than half a dozen steps along it was beyond me. Although I was worried about her, I couldn't help but feel angry, too, for putting us in this predicament. Part of me wondered if she was trying to scare us, or maybe she wanted to get rid of us, had decided that she didn't want to spend any more time in our company. She might have ducked along the line of trees and re-emerged further down the track. We didn't know her. Maybe she thought it would be funny to scare us, would be waiting for us in town with a wicked grin on her face. If we don't find her after 10 minutes, we should go back, mark the place, and go and get help. I don't want us to get lost here, I said. Do you agree? Something rustled in the foliage to our left, and Laura gasped and grabbed at me, almost knocking the torch from my grip. Laura!
Yes, I agree. 10 minutes.
I pointed the torch along the path. We could see about 10 meters ahead of us, beyond that the unknown. Except, of course, my rational brain reminded me, it would just be more path, more forest, nothing more. Imagine this is a summer day, I thought, that bright sunshine is streaming through the foliage, dancing on the path. Cute animals peek out from the branches, flowers prettily adorn the path. It's just a big wood. But it didn't work. Instead of dancing sunshine, I saw creeping shadows. There were no cute animals, only the yellow eyes of hungry predators. The pretty flowers were poisonous. Deadly nightshade and foxglove. Fallen berries were dotted here and there on the path, and I imagined that they, too, were poisonous. I took a deep breath, calming myself, and we walked on.
Alina!
Laura called. I echoed her, feeling a little foolish, worrying, too, that if there were bears here, our voices would attract them. Something dashed across the path in front of us, caught in the beam of light, and we both jumped.
Jesus!
Laura breathed. A rat, I said. I think. I looked behind me, swinging the torch, trying to memorize the point at which we'd joined the path. I turned my eyes skyward, hoping to see the moon, or the glow of a star, but the leaves above were too dense. As we walked, I could hear noises in the shadows, small animals and birds, the creak of an ancient tree as the wind stirred it. Laura's hand was warm and damp in mine, but my whole body was cold, mottled with goosebumps. I tried to speak, but my mouth was too dry. My chest felt it was about to burst open. I think we've gone in a circle, I said. We've been here before.
We can't have.
But I was sure I recognized the spot on which we were standing, that the edge of the forest was very close. The urge to flee, to turn and abandon this crazy search, was almost impossible to resist. Maybe she had got lost, had found her way back to the track, was waiting for us there now. I was about to suggest that we go back and check, when Laura said, in an urgent whisper, "Look!" Something lay on the path ahead. It was immediately obvious what it was, but I had to stoop to make sure, picking it up and holding it out to Laura. It was Alina's boot. Black leather, the zip half undone.
Oh, my God!
I swept the torchlight in a circle around us, searching for the other boot, but it was nowhere to be seen. I opened my mouth to say that we really needed to fetch help, when Laura gripped my hand and said, "Did you hear that?" "No." But then the sound came again, faint but unmistakable. A human cry.
"Oh, fuck," Laura said.
"We have to go back." But Laura was already moving forward, jogging along the path, and I unstuck my feet and followed her, both of us speeding up as the cry came again, closer this time. As we ran, taking a new, more uneven path towards the source of the noise, the forest seemed to close in on us, and in my nightmares now, when I dream of this scene, I see faces in the trees, laughing mouths and cruel eyes etched in the bark, mocking and jeering at us as we ran slowly forward. And then, without warning, the path ended, and we emerged into a large clearing. The ground was flat, stretching the size of a football pitch, the odd tree dotted here and there. Each of these trees was bent, leafless, dead. And at the center of the clearing, making me blink and stare stupidly, half convinced I was hallucinating, was a house. "What the fuck?" I said. Laura and I turned to stare at each other. The house had three stories and a flat roof, dark windows and a wooden door. It was impossible to tell how old it was, but the word that sprang to mind was ancient, as old as the forest itself. And like the blackened trees that stood hunched in the clearing, the ground around the house seemed dead, the grass tinged grey in the weak moonlight. Lights flickered in the windows. Candles, I realized, like the light that glowed in the hollows of a jack-o'-lantern. I knew with every instinct, every scrap of learned and inherited knowledge, that this was a bad place. That we needed to turn around right now and get away, that we shouldn't take another step towards this building, should not pass through that door, must not go inside. But then we heard another cry, a strangled sob from inside those stone walls, and as the silence descended again, Laura and I walked towards the house, towards the door, as if our legs had a will of their own. Chapter 8. Out we came, bursting from between the trees, back onto the path, stumbling in the half-light, almost falling, one of us catching the other, stopping only to scoop up our backpacks from the edge of the forest. We ran all the way into town. We didn't talk. We didn't look back. Part 2. London, November 2013. Chapter 9. I sat on the chair in the corner of the bedroom and stared at the empty bed. The room was musty, stale, smelled of alcoholic sweat and dirty clothes, which exploded from the overstuffed laundry basket. Used mugs and painkiller packets and unread books threatened to push each other off the bedside table. Sometimes in the night, I could hear something scratching and skittering in the walls. Rats, drawn to the spreading squalor. I needed to let some fresh air in, but the effort of doing this, of crossing the room and trying to find the key that unlocked the sash window, of forcing the frame open, was too much. Everything felt like too much effort. All I wanted to do was sleep. I was exhausted, permanently jet-lagged, with scratchy eyes and the clumsiness that comes with overtiredness. I was forever bumping into things, dropping my phone, smashing crockery. I hadn't been able to sleep, not properly, for 3 months. The quilt was folded over, so it appeared there was someone asleep in the bed. Not just someone. Laura. I could almost see and hear her soft breathing, the little snuffling sounds she made in her sleep. If I hauled myself out of this uncomfortable wooden chair and slipped my hand beneath the duvet, I would be able to feel her warm skin, stroke her hair. But the shape in the bed was not Laura. It was an empty space, a phantom, because Laura wasn't here anymore. She left in mid-October, 6 weeks ago. The day she went, I had been at a meeting that I had been unable to avoid. I would never forget the way that Camilla and Damien from Skittle had looked at me, as if wondering if the real Daniel had been body-snatched, Whether the person sitting in front of them with the chewed nails and the inability to form a coherent sentence was an impostor. I told them I'd picked up a nasty virus on my travels, was still trying to shake it off, which was a warped version of the truth. I wanted to tell them that the old Daniel, the person they knew, hadn't returned from Romania. This was the new, diminished model. Luckily, I wasn't expected to do much apart from cooperate with their PR efforts. I'd been interviewed by a couple of journalists from Wired and some other tech magazine, who asked me lots of questions about the app I'd created and the deal I'd done. My app, Heatseeker, was due to launch in the spring. Until then, I had little to do, though I kept telling myself I needed to start work on something else. I was waiting for inspiration to strike. When I got home, Laura was standing beside a black cab, the driver heaving her suitcase off the pavement. What are you doing? I asked. Laura blinked at me and got into the cab.
You all right, love?
The cabbie asked. She nodded, and he climbed into the driver's seat. Where are you going? I said, leaning through the window, fingers gripping the frame. She took a long, deep breath. I'm going to stay with Erin and Rob. They were friends of ours who lived in Camden. I could barely speak.
Why?
She shook her head sadly.
You know why, Daniel.
And then she had gone, the taxi accelerating through puddles, soaking an old woman on the other side of the road, and vanishing around the corner. I stood in the street for a long time, not aware of the rain until it dripped into my eyes, and all I could see was a watery veil that at least, though it didn't really matter, hid my tears. I hauled myself off the chair and drifted into the living room, almost tripping over the recycling box that I'd left by the door, all the empty wine bottles inside it rattling and clinking together. This reminded me that I needed to do an online grocery shop. I only had 2 bottles of alcohol left in the flat, one of which was a litre bottle of ouzo that Jake had brought back from a holiday in Greece a year ago. Poor Jake had been forced to endure several nights sitting with me while I got drunk and openly mourned my relationship. It was particularly frustrating for him because I wouldn't tell him what had created the fracture that tore Laura and me apart.
"It doesn't make sense," he kept saying. "You guys were so good together."
"I know.
Has she seen someone else? Want me to kill the bastard for you? Or put him in a song?"
"There's no one else."
"Then there's only one explanation. The two of you have gone stark raving mad."
He waited for me to respond. When I didn't, he said,
"Come on, you can tell me. I can keep a secret."
"Huh, come off it, Jake. You're the biggest gossip I've ever met. You can't resist sharing a good story."
"I'm offended, then. If you tell me it's a secret, I'll keep it right here."
He laid a hand across his heart.
"I can't keep secrets, you know."
It had rained so much in the past few weeks that I had taken to glancing out the window, expecting to see bodies floating past. While I'm not so egotistical as to think the weather is connected to my own life, it certainly felt appropriate. I had spent many days sitting in my flat, watching the rain pummel the windows, people dashing from their cars in the street below, kids splashing in puddles, while their soaked parents tried to drag them home. I wanted the rain to wash away the memory of what we'd seen and done. But all it did was cause the damp patch beneath the front window to bloom and spread and give me a good excuse to stay indoors. I entered the galley kitchen. One of the 3 light bulbs was dead, but I hadn't got round to changing it. I had a feeling that when the last bulb finally died, I would come to rely on the light from the fridge. I looked at my phone to check the time, 11:45. Too early to open the remaining Merlot, but I could have a glass with lunch. 1 o'clock was a more civilized time to have lunch, but noon was acceptable. I occupied myself for 15 minutes watching a daytime TV item about a woman who believed she'd had a sexual encounter with a ghost, then returned to the kitchen. I wasn't hungry, and there was green fur on the bread. Could I have a glass of wine without food? I knew I shouldn't, but I could taste it, anticipating its bloody thickness on my tongue. I poured 1/2 glass, hesitated, then topped it up, took it over to the sofa, and slumped in front of the TV. An item came on about center parks, a family walking through a forest. I snatched up the remote control and changed the channel. If I could sleep, could get just one decent night's rest, I was certain I would feel better, that I would be able to function again. This was one of the excuses I made for drinking, because after two bottles I would pass out. But an hour or two later, I would jerk awake, feeling like a nuclear bomb had detonated in my skull. The rest of the night would pass in a series of shifting hallucinations, some invented, some remembered, and I would try desperately to hold the door shut on my memories. Sometimes they snuck through, as if revealed by a camera flashing in the dark. Flash, my hand on the warped wooden door. Flash, a face as white as bone, twisted in torment. Flash, Laura stumbling on the crooked staircase. I swallowed a mouthful of red wine. As it slipped down my throat, I could see an image of my mum shaking her head and saying, "This won't do, will it, Daniel? This can't go on." I yelled and threw the glass across the room. It shattered against the fireplace, dark wine splattering the walls like blood spray at a crime scene, glass splinters settling on the carpet. "This can't go on." As I got to my feet, knowing that I needed to clean up the wine and the glass, a terrible weariness seizing my limbs as I contemplated it, my mobile rang. The display read, "Laura." Eagerly I pressed answer and said, "Hello?
Daniel, are you okay? You sound weird."
"Yes, I laughed. "I dropped a glass of orange juice."
"Oh, do you want me to call back later?"
"No, I mean, no, now's fine. Now's great. What's up?" It took all my acting skills to sound normal. Why was she hesitating? Was she about to tell me that she wanted to come home? Hope flared in my chest.
"I've got something I need to tell you," she said.
"What is it?" Her voice wobbled.
"I need to tell you in person."
Chapter 10. Erin and Rob Tranham lived in a house in a leafy back street of Camden, one of the most expensive parts of North London, an area where Laura and I had spent many weekends at the start of our relationship. We used to stay out drinking and dancing half the night before crashing at our friend's place, then wander, hungover and dazed, through the crowds around the market before going home. Erin's gran had bought the house for the price of a Starbucks venti latte in the 60s, signing it over to her granddaughter when she retired and moved to France. I rang the doorbell and wondered if I looked as horrible as I felt. I was on my third piece of chewing gum, trying to mask the smell of the Merlot I'd drunk at lunchtime. Rob opened the door and gestured for me to come in. He would deny it, but he did a double take when he saw me, giving me time to note how fit and healthy he was, triceps pumped like he'd just been to the gym. And then Erin appeared. Chopsticks held her hair in place, and she stood in that pose heavily pregnant women often adopt, one hand on her back. I stared at her enormous bump as Rob put a proud and protective arm around her. "Wow," I said, "it must be due soon."
"Yeah, Erin's 8 months gone, and it is a he," she said. "We're having a boy."
"A mini Rob. Congrats, mate." I shook Rob's hand. He let go quickly, backing away. Erin was looking at me with either sympathy or pity.
"Laura's in the kitchen," she said. "Come through."
I knew where the kitchen was, had cooked dinner there, mixed cocktails and cracked open beers before nights out as a foursome. But Erin was acting like I was, if not a stranger, then merely an acquaintance, someone she used to know. Maybe I thought that was true, because she only knew the old me, not this new version. I was the living embodiment of that expression, a shadow of his former self.
"Hi, Daniel."
Laura sat at the solid oak table, clinging to a cup of tea like it was a life buoy. Seeing her sent a jolt through me. She was wearing a black jumper and her hair was tied back to expose her face. She was still Laura, still lovely. But these many weeks apart allowed me to see the changes in her. Like me, she was thinner, her face paler. There was a new translucent quality to her skin. Her cheekbones were visible, her jawline sharper. Her fingernails were bitten like mine, something she never did before, berating me for the bad habit that left my cuticles in a permanent state of ruin. She had also developed a new habit in the days following our return, a habit of swiping and rubbing at her eyes, like there was something in them that bothered her. There was, she explained to me, a shape that lurked in the periphery of her vision, like when you stare at a light and see its imprint on your retina after you look away, but this imprint wouldn't fade. I sat down opposite her, and she asked me if I wanted a tea or coffee. I shook my head and looked over my shoulder. Erin and Rob had gone into the living room, giving us privacy. I wasn't sure if that was a good sign or a bad one. "How's it going?" Laura asked. Without waiting for me to reply, she said, "You look ill." "Thanks." She shrugged with one shoulder. "Sorry, but it's true. I look ill, too." "No, you look nice." Once upon a time she would have laughed at that. "I don't," she said in a flat tone. She stared into her tea, groped for more words. I hated this awkwardness between us. It wasn't fair. It wasn't right. I wanted to grab her and stare into her eyes, say, "Laura, it's me, Daniel. I'm still me and you're still you." But I didn't do that. I didn't say anything.
"So," she said, "what's happening with you? Are you working much?"
"I'm thinking," I said. She nodded, understanding. She had been struggling with work, too. "So what did you want to tell me?" I said. She took a deep breath.
"I'm moving," she said.
"Moving? Where?" She couldn't meet my eye.
"Perth."
For a moment, I wasn't sure if I'd heard correctly. "You're moving to Scotland?" She laughed, a flash of the old Laura appearing, then vanishing again.
"No. Perth in Australia."
I floundered, mouth opening, closing, then opening again. "Australia?"
"You know my aunt lives out there."
I had a vague memory of her mentioning this once. "So you're going travelling?"
"No, emigrating."
I opened my mouth, but she cut me off.
"I've already been to see an independent consultant who's helping me with the application, and she thinks I'll get enough points to be able to go, especially with my aunt sponsoring me."
It was like being punched in the head. "But why?" She looked at me.
"Do you really need me to explain?"
"Yes, I do." She hunched over the table, pushing her tea away.
"I need a completely fresh start, far away."
"Well, you couldn't get much further away."
"Exactly."
"You can't go," I said, standing up.
"Daniel, I'm only telling you out of..."
"What? Politeness?" The temperature in the kitchen had dropped several degrees. Laura frowned, her gaze fixed on the tabletop.
"I just thought you should know."
I took several deep breaths, counted to 10. "How long does it take? The application?"
"A few months."
"Months?" I had been hoping she'd say a year.
"Please be understanding," she said. "You know how unhappy I am. I need to do something to change things, and this is the best idea I've got. A completely new start. For the first time since..."
She trailed off.
"For the first time in ages, I feel excited about something. I actually feel something. Something that isn't dread or regret or fear."
"But it's running away, Laura."
"No, it's not."
"It is. Just like you ran away from me."
"Daniel, I'm not a child."
An idea grabbed me, and I scooted back into the chair opposite her, tried to grab her hand. "Let me come with you. I could emigrate too. I've always wanted to go to Australia." She looked like I'd just suggested we have sex on Erin and Rob's kitchen table.
"No. I need to do this alone."
"There's nothing to keep me here."
"Yes, there is. Your work."
"Which I can do anywhere."
"And your family, your mum, and Daniel. The whole point is that I need a break, a complete break."
My hands, which had been drumming the tabletop, fell still. "So it isn't the UK that you want to be thousands of miles from. It's me." She stood up.
"If I'd known you were going to get aggressive..."
"I'm not being aggressive."
"I thought you'd be understanding. You're the only other person who knows what I went through."
"What we went through." She got up and crossed the kitchen to the sink, filled a glass of water and took a big gulp.
"Please, I really don't want to argue about it, Daniel."
It was my turn to stand up. "Instead of running off to Australia, maybe you should do what I'm doing. Go to see a therapist." She almost dropped the glass.
"You're seeing a therapist?"
"Yes. A woman called Dr. Sauvage.
And is it helping?
I'm not sure yet.
Have you told this woman exactly what happened?
Not all of it, no. She wants to hear about how I'm feeling now. She looked relieved.
I don't want to see a therapist. I don't want to talk about any of what happened. I want to forget it, if it's at all possible for me to do so. That's why I'm moving to a new country, starting a new life.
At that moment, Erin came into the kitchen, pausing awkwardly in the doorway. Had she been listening to us? Had we raised our voices? Erin had both hands on her ripe belly, as if she were trying to protect her unborn son from listening to these arguing adults. I had an urge to tell the baby to stay in the womb, where he was safe, sheltered. It's fucked up out here, I wanted to say. It's fucked up, and there are monsters. Don't believe people when they tell you there's no such thing.
Sorry, guys, Erin said. I'm having a bit of a blood sugar crash and just need to get something to eat.
Laura moved across the kitchen, pulled out a chair and ushered her friend into it. Seamlessly, she opened the fridge door and started pulling out fruit and cheese and meat wrapped in silver foil.
What are you craving?
Erin sat down and grinned at me.
Don't worry, I'm not about to eat a pineapple and mayonnaise jelly. Just a ham sandwich would be lovely, Laura. Thanks, sweetie.
I watched as Laura made the sandwich, passing it to Erin. Even in the midst of her blood sugar crash, Erin radiated good health and vitality. 8 months pregnant. That could have been Laura now. But instead of being closer to me than ever, she was moving to the other side of the fucking world. What do you think of Laura moving to Australia? I asked. Erin took a bite of her sandwich and chewed before answering.
Of course I don't want her to go, she shook her head. I don't understand any of this. What happened to you two? You seemed so happy. What did you do, Daniel? Laura won't tell me.
He didn't do anything.
But neither of you will tell me what blew you apart. Come on, Dan. You can tell me, can't you? Did you sleep with someone else?
Laura shot me a beseeching look. We will never speak about it, she had said on the way back from Romania. Promise me. I promise. I didn't need to promise. I didn't want to talk about it either. All I wanted was to forget. If I didn't talk about it, I could pretend it had never happened, any of it. That was the only way to cope.
He didn't sleep with someone else, Laura said.
Erin sighed heavily.
All right. But I think the two of you need your heads knocking together.
She waved her sandwich in Laura's direction.
Have you told him what happened to you yesterday?
No. Laura said quickly, eyes darting nervously. What? I said. Erin's eyes were big and round. Her voice dropped to a whisper.
Tell him, Laura.
She stared at the kitchen table, chewing a thumbnail, unable to meet my eye.
I thought someone tried to kill me.
Oh, my God. Where? How?
At Charing Cross Tube Station. I was heading home from Australia House, you know, where you go to apply to emigrate and...
She broke off, still staring at the table surface, then told me what had happened at the station the day before. Chapter 11 Laura walked down the steps of Australia House, the paperwork neatly folded in her shoulder bag, feeling curiously light. She pictured herself as a helium-filled balloon set free by a careless child's hand. Alighting from the frosty city streets, up past the windows of the imposing buildings here on the Strand, floating towards the clouds, set free. How wonderful that would feel. As she walked towards Charing Cross, she kept as close to the buildings as possible, feeling reassured by the solid concrete as if it offered protection. A man emerged from one of the tiny snickets between the buildings, and Laura jumped, slapping her hand to her breastbone. She put her head down and scurried on. The last week or so, she'd felt like she was being watched. She kept seeing a figure flickering in her peripheral vision, but every time she looked, the figure was gone. She knew she was imagining it, and as if to prove this, she saw the figure again on the other side of the road, a glimpse of black clothes and white skin that vanished in the crowd. She forced herself to keep walking, eyes straight ahead. She wanted to be home. She knew she shouldn't really refer to Erin and Rob's place as home. It was temporary, a temporary shelter, which was exactly what she needed at the moment. She felt guilty about imposing on her pregnant friend for so long, but Erin insisted it was fine.
"You were there for me when Rob and I went through our sticky patch,"
Erin had said, referring to a period a couple of years ago when she had discovered Rob had come close to having an affair. Thankfully, they had worked it out.
"Besides, it will be handy to have a live-in babysitter when the little one arrives."
Everybody was being helpful. Her manager, Simone, was letting her work from home. Simone had confided in Laura that she used to suffer from agoraphobia too, believing what Laura had told her the day she'd found herself crying at the computer while her colleagues gawped at her.
"Take your time,"
she had said in that soothing voice that made Laura want to cry again from gratitude. So, thanks to Erin and Simone, Laura had a place to hole up during this period, her tarantula period, as she secretly thought of it. Last week she had watched a documentary about these spiders. "The tarantula sheds her skin once a year," the narrator explained, "then seals herself away behind a wall of silk until her new skin has hardened. Only then can she re-emerge and start to feed again." Laura never thought she would compare herself to a big scary spider, but that was exactly how she felt. She was waiting for her new skin to grow, to harden. Since Romania, the shell around her heart, like the spider's skin, had been ripped away, leaving it exposed. She was in constant pain, unable to bear the sight of others suffering, and she had realized that she was never going to heal here. That was why she had to get away. She was dreading having to tell Daniel about her plans the next day, but she knew she had to do it. She hadn't spoken to him for several weeks. Maybe he had a new girlfriend by now. He had never struggled to attract women. There was a certain type of girl like her who was attracted to the sexy geek type, who liked Clark Kent more when he was wearing his glasses than when he transformed into Superman. And Daniel hated being on his own, had barely spent a night alone in his life. There were times when she'd gone away on business, and he'd told her he'd spent the week pacing the apartment, talking to himself and going bonkers, so no, she couldn't see him staying single for long. It didn't matter that the thought of him with another woman was like a knife in her gut. She couldn't keep him trapped, hanging on, waiting to see if she came back. That would be cruel. She wanted him to be happy, and the best way for him to heal was to find someone new, to throw himself into a new relationship. If she was his doctor, that's what she would prescribe. By moving to the other side of the world, she would make it easier for him. She bit down on the urge to cry. Moments later, she arrived at Charing Cross Station. She stopped. All these people. It was even busier now than it had been earlier when she'd taken the tube from Camden. She tried not to look at anyone. Maybe she should get a cab. But she needed to hang on to every penny she could at the moment, would need it for her big move. As long as she didn't look at anybody, she should be okay. Plus, it was stupid for her to be scared of crowds. It was the empty places that ought to scare her. She descended the steps into the station, clinging to the handrail like an elderly lady. The people below her shuffled about like zombies. She had a flash of one of them twisting towards her, vacant eyes rolling, teeth bared, grabbing her and ripping her throat out. She shook the image away and counted to five beneath her breath. "Come on," she urged herself, "you can do this." She followed the signs to the platform, heading towards the far end. The display board showed there was a train due in 4 minutes. In that 4 minutes, more and more people entered the platform, many of them heading to where Laura stood. She was surrounded, bodies too close to her, the smell of the McDonald's fries the woman next to her clutched in her fist, making Laura want to be sick. "For fuck's sake," she muttered, squinting at the board. Then she heard the rumbling of an approaching train, thank God, and looked down at the track. A tiny malformed mouse darted between the rails. She jerked her head up. It wasn't only the people that scared her about train travel. It was the sight of the track, the rails. An image appeared in her mind. She and Daniel running along the tracks towards the town, stumbling and tripping but staying upright, the sun rising, her throat raw from screaming, and Daniel had caught hold of her arm and... She lurched towards the edge of the platform. Arms windmilling. She could see the mouse, frozen between the rails, and she was falling, falling, and a roaring noise came from the tunnel, air blasting along the platform, the train rocketing into the light. Someone grabbed her from behind, almost went over with her, but fought them both back from the edge. A tall man wearing a suit. He held her. She couldn't catch her breath. The man held on to her, murmuring in her ear, telling her to calm down. It's okay. Calm down. It's all okay. She pulled free of his grip and looked around. Everyone was staring at her, but the tube train was at the platform now, and the doors were opening, so their attention quickly wandered. "What happened?" the man who had caught her asked. "Did you trip?" She couldn't remember tripping, but said, "I must have. I'm always tripping over my own feet." She thanked him and tried to give him money from her purse, which made him laugh. He got under the train, and she could feel him watching her as the doors beat and slid shut. Had she tripped? Or had somebody pushed her? She was sure she could feel the imprint of hands on her spine. She looked around, more people emerging into the station. If someone had pushed her, they were long gone by now. She closed her eyes and took a long, deep breath. She must have tripped. Lost in her reverie, she had walked into someone, probably stumbled over one of those annoying wheelie suitcases. That was all. It was ridiculous to think that anyone here might want to kill her. She'd boarded the next train and found a seat, a memory coming back to her. As she'd clung to the man who saved her, she'd seen a figure pushing hurriedly through the crowd away from her. She couldn't tell if it was a man or woman. She couldn't... She killed the thought, reminded herself that it was stupid to think like this. By the time she'd reached her stop, she had convinced herself that she had imagined it. Chapter 12. Dr. Claudia Sauvage's office was on the top floor of her huge red-brick Victorian terrace in Crouch End. Sometimes, on my way up the stairs to the room at the back of the house, where we had our weekly sessions, I would catch glimpses of her life outside the therapy room. The smell of soup wafting from the kitchen. Photos of Dr. Sauvage and her husband, framed and hung in the hallway, a couple of pugs poking their squashed faces out of the living room. But I wasn't allowed to ask Claudia about herself. Our sessions were dedicated wholly to talking about me. The first session had been dedicated to filling Claudia in on my background. I wasn't sure how pertinent it was, but Claudia said it was important to get as much detail as possible so she could understand and help me. So I told her that I grew up in Beckenham, on the outskirts of South London, and was an only child. My parents were divorced, and we weren't particularly close. Claudia wanted to know a lot more about this, but I was reluctant to talk about it. I didn't think it was important. But she scribbled notes as I told her that I only saw them now at Christmas, and on the odd special occasion. They had both remarried and thrown themselves into new lives with new partners. They usually wanted to talk about what the other one was up to, as if they were competing to be happier. I didn't want to get drawn into it. I spent much of my adolescence in my bedroom playing video games and learning how to code. I was a geek until I discovered music and met Jake, who showed me that life outside my bedroom was a lot more interesting. From that point, I spent a lot of time trying to work out who I was. I was naturally mathematical, scientific, but I yearned to be artistic, bohemian. I studied computer science at university, but went out drinking a lot and had a series of short-term girlfriends, all of whom were studying one of the arts. I stopped reading science fiction and read the books these girls pressed on me, Donna Tartt, Douglas Copeland, lots of Penguin classics. I experimented with soft drugs and watched a lot of films with subtitles. After college, I moved to North London and worked for an internet startup for a few years before getting into app development in my spare time. I met Laura, via Jake, and fell in love for the first and only time. Laura was everything I'd ever wanted, well-read, arty, passionate, and principled. She encouraged me to embrace my true nature, to do the things I enjoyed without worrying about the image I projected. She helped me figure out who I am. I filled our flat with gadgets, and she made it come to life with clutter and candles and bright colours. "It's interesting," Dr. Sauvage said, "how when I ask you to talk about yourself, you quickly start telling me about your girlfriend." I shrugged. "My life is unremarkable." She smiled. "No life is unremarkable." Dr. Sauvage was in her mid-40s, thin and elegant, with slender wrists and legs that I found it hard not to stare at. She wore fashionable glasses and a dark grey jersey dress. During our sessions, she puffed on an electronic cigarette, sending clouds of water vapour into the air. She'd asked if I minded, which I didn't at all. "I'm more addicted to this than I ever was to real cigarettes," she confided. "So," she said now, "how are you feeling, Daniel?" When I didn't answer, she said, "How about your sleep? Any better?" I adjusted my position in the armchair. "No, I only got 2 hours last night, maybe three." She waited for me to continue. "I've got something new to worry about," I said.
"Oh?"
"Laura, my girlfriend, my ex-girlfriend," I sighed. "She's leaving the country, going to Australia. Fucking Australia. Sorry." A tiny smile at my apology.
"You can swear if you need to, Daniel. And how do you feel about this?"
"How do I feel? I'm devastated. I don't want her to go. I can't let her go. She's just trying to run away after what happened. It's insane. I really won't be able to bear it if she goes away." She raised her hand, seeing how agitated I was becoming. I took 5 deep, slow breaths, closed my eyes, tried to visualize something pleasant, but all I could see was Laura, and then worse. I wrenched my eyelids open.
"Do you think that Laura would be interested in coming to a session with you? It might be helpful to both of you. When a family experiences a trauma together, it's common to treat them as a unit, the same with couples."
"She won't do it. I tried to talk about it, but she's not interested. She won't even speak with me about what happened. She certainly won't talk to you."
"And what about you?"
she asked, her voice gentle.
"Will you speak with me about it?"
So far, all I had managed to talk about was what had happened leading up to the walk along the rail tracks. I had spent the first couple of sessions telling her about the good stuff, our first weeks travelling around Europe, the fun times. I had also told her about our plans, our reasons for going, all the things that had been lost. And last week I had told her what happened on the train, about finding ourselves at the deserted station with the feral dogs. Post-traumatic stress disorder. That's what the NHS psychologist had diagnosed me with, something that I associated with war vets or the firefighters who had tried to save people from the World Trade Center. But when they described the symptoms, I ticked pretty much every box. Intense, intrusive memories of the traumatic event, nightmares, loss of interest in life, lack of motivation, insomnia, a feeling of being on constant red alert, being easily startled, substance abuse, alcohol in my case. The list went on for pages. Dr. Sauvage had told me that she wanted to try what she called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy.
"When you suffer from PTSD, she said during our first session,
telling me she agreed with the NHS psychologist's assessment,
"you want to block out memories of the trauma. You will do anything to avoid confronting it, or anything that reminds you of it. PTSD is where your brain remains in psychological shock, unable to shake off or move on from what happened to you."
That makes sense.
"To get better, to move on, you need to face the memories, deal with them, which will allow you to regain control and feel able to face the future. To do that, we need to carefully expose you to those memories, to peel away the barriers."
I had shuddered visibly.
"The key word being carefully, Daniel. You have nothing to be frightened of."
"You don't get it."
"I do."
She had cocked her head.
"Do?"
"Have something to be frightened of." Now I looked over at her, sitting on her designer chair with her notepad on her lap, e-cigarette in her hand, and wondered if I'd ever be able to tell her everything. "I can tell you what happened afterwards," I said. "That's all part of it anyway."
"All right," she responded. "That would be good. Take your time. Go slowly. And if you start to feel distressed, stop talking, okay?"
"Okay." I sat back and closed my eyes. I can't really remember much of the walk into town. We started off running, but our backpacks were so heavy we had to slow down. I know we didn't talk much. I kept opening my mouth to speak, but all I could think of to say were stupid questions like, "Are you okay?" When, of course, I knew she was a very long way from okay. And all I could think about was getting as far away as possible. I glanced up at Dr. Sauvage. I was in shock. We both were. But I remember the same words looping through my head. "We need to get home." I paused. Actually, I don't think it was that coherent. If there were fully formed words in my head, it was more like screaming, like white noise. Also, Laura said afterwards that she remembered screaming as we ran out of the forest, but I don't remember that. In my memory, she didn't make a sound. It was quiet in the office, like it had been in the forest. A fly crawled up the window, and I thought I could hear its footsteps. The town at the end of the tracks was called Breva. When we got there, it was just getting light, but nothing was open yet. Though, walking through the town, it didn't seem like there was much of anything anyway. There was nobody around. We saw a man walking a dog, a huge thing, like a wolf, which made Laura grip my hand so hard I thought she'd break my fingers. We saw a young guy walking along with a baseball cap on, head down. A few cars went past. After everything that had happened, what we wanted to see was a city, lights, life, not this. The whole place had this bleak feel, full of boarded-up windows and cars that looked like they should be in a scrapyard. Lots of signs of a place that used to be prosperous and lively, but that was now dying. I don't know. It just had this atmosphere. It felt like a ghost town. She waited for me to continue. After we'd walked for 10 minutes or so, we saw an old lady scrubbing the front step of her house. I said to her, "Police?" And she looked us up and down before coming over and giving us directions, pointing this way and that and babbling away like we could understand every word. But we got the gist anyway. I pictured the old lady now, her milky eyes, her strong arms clutching the wooden brush she'd been using to clean the step. Just before we walked off, she reached up and touched Laura's face, whispered something in Romanian. I thought Laura was going to start screaming, and I had to pull her away. I left out a detail. The woman had also touched Laura's belly, laying the flat of her hand on my girlfriend's stomach and nodding to herself. Laura had jerked away like the woman had stabbed her. "This is good," Dr. Sauvage said. "How are you feeling?"
"Okay."
"Able to go on?"
"Yes, I want to get to the end."
I also wanted a strong drink. I told the rest of the story.
Chapter 13. Laura and I found the police station about 10 minutes after our encounter with the elderly woman, a little building with Policia written above the door. I took a deep breath before trying the door. A police officer sat at the desk in the tiny reception area, a smartphone in one hand, a mug in the other. He looked up at us and frowned at me, then smiled at Laura. "Do you speak English?" I asked. He shrugged apologetically. I immediately switched into Englishman abroad mode, speaking slowly and turning up the volume. "Anyone here speak English?" He eyed me before drifting to the back of the reception area and vanishing through a door. He returned a minute later with a large man with red cheeks and broken veins on his nose. He took in Laura's messy hair, the dirt and scratches on our skin. I hadn't looked in a mirror at this point, so I had no idea how beaten up I looked, how the dash through the forest had marked me, how wild my eyes were.
"How can we help?"
I didn't know where to start. I gabbled, mixing the whole thing together non-sequentially, the train, the forest, Alina, the border guards. The policeman held up two huge hands.
"Okay, slow, please. I don't understand."
He came up past the desk and gestured for us to follow him, saying something in his native tongue to his colleague, who gave us a dark look that I didn't understand. The large policeman instructed us to leave our backpacks behind the desk, then led us down a short corridor, seeing us into what I assumed to be an interview room, where we sat down on a pair of plastic chairs. Laura still hadn't spoken. She sat there shivering and staring into space. The policeman kept glancing at her suspiciously.
"What are your names?" he asked.
I told him and watched him write them down.
"I am Constantine."
I wasn't sure if this was his first or second name.
"Okay, tell me from the start, okay?"
So I told him about what had happened on the train, that we had fallen asleep in the sleeper carriage, that we had been woken up to find that our passports, ticket and money had been stolen, that we'd been thrown off. He looked up from his notes.
"Why were you thrown off?"
"Because we had no tickets."
"You had no ticket?"
The atmosphere in the room changed. He glanced at Laura again, who was shivering even harder now, her teeth chattering. "I think she's in shock," I said. "Do you have a blanket? A hot, sweet drink?" He ignored my request, going back to his previous question.
"So, You were on the train with no ticket.
No, we had tickets, but they were stolen. He shook his head, like this made no sense. I didn't want to tell him that we had been in a private compartment that we hadn't paid for, or even that Alina had intervened and angered the guards. I felt instinctively that this policeman would side with other men in uniform. He pointed at Laura with his pencil.
Your girlfriend? She is on drugs?
No, I told you, she's in shock. She needs medical attention, and I need to tell you about what we saw in the house in the forest. The pen he had been tapping on the desk went still.
House in the forest?
Yes, that's what we're here to tell you about. He stared at me.
Let me see your passport.
I told you that too. They were stolen.
Beside me, Laura made a whimpering noise.
Listen, she really needs to see a doctor. Oh, please, a sweet drink.
He sighed heavily and made a great show of hefting himself to his feet. He left the room and came back a minute later with a tepid can of Coke, which he set before Laura. I cracked it open and passed it to her. She took a sip and winced.
So, the policeman said, you have no identity.
I opened my mouth to reply, but no words emerged.
Does anybody know you are here?
No, but I produced my dead iPhone from my pocket. Can you let me charge my phone so I can call home, or let me use yours?
Wait.
He got up and left. Beside me, Laura's shivering had abated somewhat, but she still appeared on the verge of passing out. I put my arm around her shoulders, tried to pull her closer. She could have been made of stone. This was maddening. Konstantin hadn't yet given us a chance to tell him what had happened in the house in the forest. The vision of it loomed up inside my head, and I dug my fists into my eyes as if I could rub the memory away. I had to tell him. I paced the room for 10 minutes, Laura sitting silently, before Konstantin finally returned. He didn't have a phone with him. He had the demeanour of someone who'd just been asked to make a difficult decision. Before he could sit down, I blurted, I need to tell you what happened. There's been a crime.
In the house in the forest.
At that point, the policeman who had been on the front desk appeared in the doorway and said something to Konstantin in Romanian. Konstantin huffed impatiently.
Wait here, he said,
placing his hands on his thighs and pushing himself to his feet. Before he left the room, he turned back and said,
you are sure? No one knows you are here.
No, I'm sure. He left the room, and I heard their footsteps recede, their voices growing quieter. We have to go, I said to Laura. Her expression was blank. I took hold of her arm and pulled her up. Come on. We need to go now.
But
there's something not right here, I said. Why does he keep asking if anyone knows we're here? I don't like it. I went to the doorway and looked out. There was no one in sight, and I couldn't hear either of the police officers any more. It's clear. Let's go. Laura staggered to her feet, and I put my arm around her. I took another look down the corridor. I could see nothing, but could hear shouting. Maybe Konstantin had been called away to deal with a difficult prisoner. Whatever, we had to take our chance to get out of this place. We hurried to the exit, reaching the reception desk, which was now empty.
Our backpacks, Laura said in a quiet voice. Where are they?
We'll have to leave them, I said. I was so convinced that Konstantin was not to be trusted that leaving the backpacks behind seemed like a necessary sacrifice. As we stepped out into what was now a warm, sunny morning, I felt a surge of relief. I took Laura's hand and pulled her along, asking someone for directions to the train station as we went. We cut across a field towards the station, and to my great relief, I had just enough cash in my pocket to pay for a train out of town.
What happened after that?
Dr. Sauvage asked, blowing a stream of water vapour into the air. In the distance, I could hear cars. A man shouting, a door banging, but above this, I could hear my own heartbeat, the rushing in my ears like I was underwater.
Daniel?
I turned towards her. Our tickets only took us to another small town, where we found a pawnbroker who was willing to buy my watch. I got just enough for the fare to Bucharest. Once we got there, we found the British Embassy, and after lots of phone calls, they gave us temporary travel documents and found us a flight.
Did you tell anyone else what had happened?
No. We haven't told anybody.
But
we couldn't. We can't. Her voice was soothing.
Daniel, I hope you will soon be able to tell me, like I've already told you. Only then will you be able to deal with the way you feel.
There was a thinning patch on my jeans, where the denim was almost worn through. I stared at it now, unable to meet Dr. Sauvage's eye.
You don't... I don't know if I can. Not yet. Maybe next time.
We had another appointment later that week.
What are you seeing, Daniel, in your mind's eye?
A Polaroid exhibition of horror.
What?
I lifted my eyes towards her.
Polaroids, I repeated. Flash. A crouching man, a glint of metal. Flash. Numbers scrawled in ink. 13, 8, 13. Flash, flash, flash. I stood up. I have to go.
Daniel,
I'm sorry.
I left Dr. Sauvage's office and headed down the road. I felt queasy, still reeling from telling even just the part of my tale I'd been able to share. I thought about my watch in the pawnbroker's shop in the little town in Romania, the name of which I couldn't remember now. That watch had been a present from Laura to celebrate my deal with Skittle. It had cost half a month's salary, but that wasn't what mattered. She'd had it engraved with a few simple words. Till the end of time, Laura. XXXX. I took the bus back to Angel and visited the supermarket. Milk, bread, paracetamol, red wine, white wine, before heading back to my flat. Even as I headed up the stairs, I knew something was wrong. I lived in an old Victorian building that had been divided into flats. Laura and I had long been planning to move to somewhere bigger and better, but even with the windfall from the sale of my app, we couldn't afford it. I hardly ever saw my neighbours. My main contact with them was when they pinned notices to the wall in the lobby, complaining about each other. Noisy parties, bicycles and buggies left in the hall, somebody failing to put their recycling in the correct bin, another miscreant parking in the wrong spot. But today, the atmosphere was quieter and emptier than ever. I reached the second floor and saw that my door had splintered around the lock. It had been kicked in. Tentatively, I pushed the door open. Chapter 14. In the living room, the bookshelves had been emptied, paperbacks scattered across the floor like bricks from a bombed building. Paperwork from the desk lay among the mess, the drawers half open. In the bedroom, the chest of drawers had suffered the same fate. There were clothes everywhere, along with pills and condoms and random items from the bedside table. Boxes had been pulled from beneath the bed and emptied, and photographs tossed aside, Laura's face smiling up at me from the floor. In the bathroom, the sink was full of pill bottles and a tube of toothpaste lay squashed on the lino, its contents squirted across the floor where someone had trodden on it. I went back into the living room and looked around, mouth dry, heart thudding. My laptop, which had been charging on the desk, was gone. My recent work, what there was of it, had been saved to the cloud, but there were other files, including most of my photos, that I hadn't backed up yet. Logins to my bank account, social media accounts, e-commerce sites, every website I used, it was all saved on there too. My computer set to automatically log into nearly all of them. With that laptop, anyone could run riot through my life. I looked around to see what else was missing. The PlayStation 4, my iPad, the Bluetooth speaker that I listened to music on. So they had only taken gadgets, as far as I could tell. Had they made a mess just for the hell of it? Or had they been looking for hidden jewellery and cash? I called the police, then phoned my bank and asked them if I could temporarily freeze my account. I needed to get to another computer so I could change all my passwords, and I didn't want to be alone here among this mess, the rotten ambience of my violated home. I went back into the bedroom, treading gingerly through the debris. I sat on the bed and picked up a photo of Laura. She was so beautiful, and soon she would be 6,000 miles away. Erin answered the door, looking even more pregnant than she had the day before. "Hello again," she said, kissing my cheek. "Laura's not here."
"Oh. But you can come in and wait if you like. To be honest, I'm going completely out of my mind with boredom.
Maternity leave is great at first, but there's only so much daytime TV a woman can take. Now, I just want this little bugger to arrive.
We sat at the kitchen table where I'd sat the day before. There was a giant cardboard box on the side full of nappies and bottles and baby wipes.